Hello and welcome to another edition of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have Leith here today to run through the Australia is in a per capita recession and has been for some time, and the big question, does it matter? And so we're going to run through some of the charts, have a bit of a deeper look. Before we get into that, just a quick reminder that to hit the subscribe buttons. And everything you hear today, none of it is personal advice. If you do want personal advice, give us a call, book in for a meeting. Everything we're talking about is general investment advice. With that out of the way, I will leap straight into Leith and say, we had the results yesterday, GDP out yesterday. What were your thoughts? Big picture, and then we'll get into some of the detail.
Yeah, thanks, Damien, and hello, everyone. So on Wednesday, the Australian Bureau of Statistics released the Q4 national accounts for Australia. So that's basically where you get your GDP numbers and all the main economic data. Now, it is obviously backward-looking. So this is for the December quarter. We're obviously in March, so it's almost a quarter behind. But what it did show is that the Australian economy is incredibly weak. So if you look at the overall economic pie, Australia's GDP grew by 0.2% over the quarter and 5% over the year. Now, that was slightly weaker than what economists' expectations were. So economists were tipping about 0.3% growth. It's also marginally, only slightly, below what the Reserve Bank's projections were for the quarter. They also tipped 0.3%. So the economy is a little bit softer than what they were tipping. Now, the bigger thing here is the actual contributions to growth. So the thing that drove Australia's growth over the December quarter was net exports. So basically what happened was we had a massive fall in import volumes over the quarter. They fell by about 3.5%, and that actually contributed about 0.7% to Australia's growth. And that basically is a reflection of weak demand of the economy. We imported less, so it was a big destock of inventories and things like that. But the thing that the most important aspect to look for is that the household sector, so the household sector comprises nearly 60% of the growth. And that's basically what most people care about, because we're all households, right? We live in that world. Household consumption only grew by 0.1% in the quarter, and it's incredibly weak, and actually fell in per capita terms. 0.1% over the year for 2023, and once you adjust for population growth, household spending actually fell by 2.4%. So, which was weaker than the fall in per capita GDP growth of 1%.
Yep. Now, these are real numbers as well, aren't they?
That's right. So inflation adjusted.
Yeah, inflation adjusted. So 3-ish% inflation, depending upon what your thing is. So volumes very weak, and absolute prices, slightly up.
Yeah, and the key thing to think is, so over the year, the economy grew at 1.5%, but the population grew by 2.6% almost. So it's another case that we had basically a third straight quarter of per capita recession, whereby the overall economic pie grew, but everyone sliced the pie shrank. And that's basically been the story for, a while now. But the bigger thing, and this is the thing that's probably going to matter more for the Reserve Bank of Australia, is the consumption. So the household consumption fell, as I said, by nearly 2.5% last year, which is, that's a big decline. And it's actually a lot worse than what the Reserve Bank had tipped. So in the November statement of monetary policy, the Reserve Bank had tipped that household consumption would be 1.1% in Q4. And then it revised that down last month in the February statement of monetary policy, tipped 0.4%. Instead, we only got 0.1%. That's obviously before adjusting for population growth. So, what that tells you is that, and I think this will actually surprise the RBA, the household sector consumer spending is a lot worse than what the Reserve Bank had expected, even as early as last month. And that, to me, is just another sign. We basically had all these economic indicators come out that have been worse than what the Reserve Bank expected. So, inflation's been lower, the unemployment rate's rising faster than they expected, retail sales have been worse. And then now we've obviously got, overall GDP was marginally worse than they expected, but the household sector was a lot worse than what the Reserve Bank had expected. And this basically just plays into the whole theme that we've been running on macro business for a long time, that the Reserve Bank is going to cut rates in the second half of this year.
Yeah.
And
so, I mean, it's interesting. We've posited with Dave a few times this idea that you know, Australia came out lagging the rest of the world because our lockdowns lasted longer, and so you know, we were sort of behind the cycle. But that it maybe looks like we've caught up, and particularly in the case of the US, you know, I guess they're now beating them on the way down by the.
Yeah, and in some ways we're actually ahead in certain ways. Like, so we're obviously a bit later to start raising rates, but we've also got a lot more quicker transmission in our monetary policy because we have such a high share of variable rate mortgages and very short-term fixed rates, which are all pretty much expired now. You know, the Reserve Bank's obviously hiked rates by 4.25%, which is, say, less than, say, New Zealand, which did 5.25%, but we have a much quicker transmission in our monetary policy. So when the RBA hikes rates, it flows through the household sector very quickly because most of us are on variable rate mortgages. Now, if you want to look at the other extreme to that, the United States, you know, most of them are on, you know, these sort of 25-year or 30-year fixed rate mortgages.
Mm.
So the Federal Reserve's hiked rates, but it hasn't really flowed onto the households to nearly the same degree as Australia. So in some ways,
it's new houses, people who are transacting houses, but home buyers straight away in the US. Australia takes
the overall.
And look,
you know, Australia does have a different sort of inflation problem. Like a lot of ours is, I'd argue it's homegrown. So, you know, obviously running very high immigration at the moment, and that's pushed up rents and housing inflation. And also we've obviously totally messed up energy policy. So, but at the same time, our wage growth is a lot weaker than elsewhere, would you believe? So despite all this talk of, you know, Australia's wages going up and we have a wage breakout, our wage growth has actually lagged the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So we do have different circumstances here a little bit.
And so that's worth digging into because, I mean, the worry in the US for policymakers there is that you've got wages growth, that's going to flow into services inflation, which then cycles back into wages growth, and you've got that sort of ever rising cycle. We don't have that here. So
no.
I guess the question is, it would seem to me as an interested investor, is that, you know, you look at Australia, and as you said, it's homegrown in terms of a lot of its house prices, which is sort of driven by this extreme
and
population and rents. Yep. So rents is probably the bigger one in there, isn't it? And
yep.
And as you said, the energy policy, we're playing that higher than what we thought. And there's obviously then this sort of crush loading idea that, you know, it's not just rents. There'll be other things as well that are sort of capacity constrained in terms of having people, lots more people. So. And then the flip side, because we've got so many people, the wage growth's really weak, so you're not going to get that same sort of, you're not going to get that same cycle. But raising interest rates isn't going to solve energy because it's a global price. Doesn't really matter what's happening in Australia. It's not going to solve houses. It's probably actually going to make things worse, you'd think, because fewer people will build houses with higher interest rates, and it's not fixing the wage growth problem. So, you know, it's always the wrong. Whereas you can see in the US, there's an argument to keep them higher to keep wage growth down. It's not necessary in Australia, and raising rates isn't fixing any of the main sources of our inflation.
Yeah, and also, look, I'd argue that, you know, that the US economy is a lot stronger than ours. So the US economy is actually going through a growth phase compared to, you know, us and Canada and New Zealand and even the UK. Like, we're all having quite strong per capita recessions at the moment, and some of them outright recessions, whereas the US has actually got some decent growth in comparison. So, you know, we do have different circumstances, but even then, I think even with these homegrown inflation pressures, we're going to get rate cuts the second half of the year. And the main data point to look at, David, is actually the unemployment rate. So the February statement of monetary policy projections from the Reserve Bank projected that by the end of this year, Australia's unemployment rate would only hit 4.3%. And we're already at 4.1%. So that's as of January, with 11 months to go to hit that. And basically, I think the Reserve Bank was very, you know, way too bullish, way too optimistic in their unemployment rate forecast. And because pretty much every single leading indicator is showing that unemployment is going to rise. So if you're looking at, you know, the SEEK number of applicants per job ads, and there's a whole bunch of other ones suggest that the unemployment rate is going to rise. Also, unemployment's a lagging indicator. So with the economy this weak, especially in the household sector and domestic demand, it's only a matter of time before unemployment ratchets higher. And it'll, you know, I honestly think in the next few months, we're already going to hit the Reserve Bank's unemployment rate forecast that they had for December 31. We're going to hit that in the next couple of months. And when we do breach that, that'll obviously, you know, set the course for a pivot on interest rates and then, you know, rate cuts in the second half. So that's kind of my thinking there.
Yeah. Given one of the things that's interesting to me from a company perspective, sort of looking at it, it's sort of this bottom up and how do we sort of analyze what's going on, is that if you look at grocery prices, which is sort of in one of your charts there, is still relatively high in terms of that food cost. So that the underlying food cost to the money that's going to farmers is pretty low. Like there hasn't been inflation there, and arguably there's deflation in various components of that. There's the margins are reasonable for supermarkets. Except they're not. Well, they've certainly gone up more than you expect, but they're not like far and away booming. And it seems to be because, to me, sort of analysing the company, it seems to be because it's all the way down. Everyone's just taking a little bit more all the way down the supply chain, all the way up and down the supply chain. And I guess the question is on these. Yeah, we'd like capitalism to kick in at some time, and in the sectors where there is lots of competition, transport's a good example, or things like cars and tires and all that type of stuff, where we saw prices go up and now prices are genuinely declining. It doesn't seem to be happening in that food part. So even though the farmers' prices shot up and then the farmers' prices came back down again, but it all got pushed through to the supermarkets and that hasn't come down. I guess from a macro perspective, I'd be interested in your thoughts in terms of this, whether you can see that, or whether there's any sort of macro stats in terms of the pressures that Australia versus other countries. I guess what I'm trying to come to is, does which sectors should we be worried about capitalism kicking in? And is it that, because Coles and Woolies make up such a large market share, that's one place where it might not actually come through.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's I guess two angles to that. So the first one is, pretty much anything that comes in off a container ship is coming down in price. So we're sort of getting, disinflation or outright deflation, those sorts of things. So, we're talking about your consumer items, et cetera, your TVs, washing machines, anything that's manufactured. China's basically, exporting deflation now. And that's helping to push down goods inflation, and that's helping to obviously lower, overall inflation. The pressure points is more this domestic stuff you talk about. And Australia does obviously have a very concentrated marketplace, not just in supermarkets, but we do have a lot of embedded inflation across the board. And, classic example here is, toll roads, right? So we've got a litany of toll roads built around the country now. Most of them are transurban. All their contracts now have basically got embedded, CPI plus toll hikes. So whenever inflation goes up, it automatically gets passed on in higher toll roads.
Yep.
They can pass it on four times a year, and then then sort of gets this second round inflation.
And you don't even see it anymore. Be like, in the old days when you used to have to shell out the coins to put it in, you're like, oh, they just raised it. Whereas now you don't even notice.
No, and it's four times a year. But we have that pretty much across the economy in so many different areas.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's insurance or whatever. And
disclaimer, we own Transurban in our portfolio for exactly that reason.
As we should.
They are the masters, as I've always said, of going to governments and saying, if Leith is the premier of a state, I'll turn up to Leith and say, hey, Leith, I've got this deal for you. It's going to be a crappy deal over the next 50 years, but it's going to be fantastic until the next election. Would you like?
Yep, and it's going to look great on the budget because you can hold it off balance sheet. You're not going to have greater government debt. So not yet. So
at the next election, fantastic. That's all I care about. I don't care about the next 50 years. Yeah.
And I'm obviously picking on Transurban, but this is across the economy, right? So we're basically saying, massive sway of the privatizations for, this is a philosophical discussion. We'd have a bigger one later, or another time. But basically, we've privatized everything to a certain degree. We've also sort of contracted out things that used to be done by government to these private players. And now we basically have, I call them sort of private taxes. So your toll road payments, et cetera, are kind of like a private tax, right?
Yep.
And a lot of those are linked to inflation. So if you have we've had this kind of, initially the inflation spike was caused by supply constraints internationally, obviously stimulus pushed up demand. We had supply bottlenecks everywhere, shipping lanes shut, factories closed down temporarily because of the pandemic. and the virus, et cetera, and that pushed up everything. And then, but then that inflation shock then filters into all those other areas like toll roads, pricing, and a whole bunch of stuff. And then that just sort of embeds this inflation. So, I assume with the, you know, what's going on with the supermarkets is a bit of that at play, sort of more fresh food and et cetera. Although I do notice that, at least at my shops, a lot of the goods that rocketed in price. So for example, I buy this Greek yogurt every week. It went from $8.50, $7.50 before the pandemic to $8.50. Then we had the inflation spike, went to $12.50. Now it's actually come back to $10.50.
Right.
And I've noticed that in a whole bunch of goods. So I think there has been some moderation then.
That's a classic one though as well. I was thinking exactly the same thing in terms of the yogurt is like, you know, is that the milk price has, you know, went up for a bit, but it's back. So farmers aren't making any more from that.
No.
Is there any more of the production? Maybe. And it's still... There's no more of the transport. It's not a... Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of goes up 50% then... It goes up 50% and pulls back 15. You know what I mean? Yeah, we sort of say that across the spectrum, I think, on our shops. You know, can we do anything about it? Probably not.
That comes back to the ACCC decision the other day with Suncorp, doesn't it? Is the ACCC decided, no, this is uncompetitive. We've got a concentrated banking market. We don't need any more concentration. And then overturned by judges.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's it. So the ACCC's got a couple hundred people who did this analysis and wrote this report and came up with this decision. And then you had 10 people on the Competition Appeals Tribunal overturn it. So, which then just sends the signal, sends a bad precedent for starters. Like if you're any of the other big players, banks, you might as well take over a mid-tier bank because you know you've got a precedent now to do it.
Yes.
But also, it also tells the ACCC, you know, don't do your job.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and we've already got enough problems with, relationships between the regulators and the people who are being regulated. Like, you know, we've already identified that for, the whole banking, half the Banking Royal Commission was about that, wasn't it? That we've just got too cozy of a relationship between regulators and then, so the first time the regulators says, well, not the first time, but, you know, there's been a few times that the regulators have stepped up and gone, oh, okay, I'm going to try and find Westpac a whole bunch of money. And the courts went, no, you're not. And then they're standing up going, oh, we're going to stand in the way of competition. And courts are like, no, you're not. And saying, well, yes, it's a, we're not helping ourselves. So I mean, and that's, I guess it's an argument for structurally higher inflation, generally. But then the question comes back to if there's no per capita, if we're in a per capita recession and so we're going to be at, you know, I think we're back to 2018 levels, are we now?
The per capita we're basically I think back to roughly sort of pre COVID levels, I guess, of growth. Consumption at least we're back to sort of 2018 levels for household consumption. Which is the thing. Look, let's face it. That's the thing that you know Australians should care about because we live in the household sector. We're not an exporter. We're not a we're not government business, et cetera. Like,
yeah, that's right.
Households don't care about.
Price doubles, your household budget doesn't go up by 10%.
That's it. That's right. So in terms of, and we've obviously living standards have been smashed. So I haven't quite calculated the data yet. I'll do that tonight once I get the Reserve Bank spreadsheet. They always do a spreadsheet 2 days after national accounts come out on household disposable income, and then I deflate it by per capita. So it's it's the way I calculate that. And as of the September quarter, we experienced like a 6% annual decline in real per capita household disposable incomes. Now, I think it actually rebounded marginally in Q4 because for some reason, quirk in the statistics, we had less income tax paid. But even so, Australian households have experienced one of the biggest declines in per capita household disposable income in history and one of the worst in the world. And it's just another, sign here that the household sector's been smashed. And that's really what I think the Reserve Bank should be concentrating on, like not net exports, et cetera. I think they'll be looking at the household sector first and foremost, because that's the thing that's obviously impacted most by interest rates. And it's also, most telling for the labor market, et cetera.
Now, we are about to get some tax cuts. So I guess the question for that was partly, I guess, the title for the slide, does it matter we're in a per capita recession or not? was sort of around this idea that, look, if we've got very weak income growth, but we're going to top up everyone's salaries with very weak income growth, and we've got this inflation that hasn't really come back, so companies are making more money than perhaps they might if we had a stronger competition. But then we sort of juice it by a tax cut. Does that then lead to sort of that sort of lifts the glide path so that things don't look as bad for the whole of 2024?
Yeah, at the margin it does. But at the same time, so the CBA economics team did some great analysis on the stage for a tax cut. So then they did some projections. And so basically in the year to September, so I'm not sure what it is in the year to December yet, but in the year to September, basically income tax payments went up by about 22.5%, whereas overall wages and salaries went up 7.5%. So basically we had this massive rising bracket creep, which pulled everyone into higher average tax brackets.
Yep. It's on one of these charts you had there.
Yeah, in fact, it's the bottom right chart on the second last slide. There's a chart here from Justin Farbo at Antipodean Macro. And you can see that blue line there shows income tax payments. And you can see they rose significantly in the September, and then they dipped a little bit in the December quarter. But
yeah, so for anyone listening in, so the income tax payments went from sort of, 2010, they were back at sort of 14%. They've been rising relatively since then up to, as a percentage of disposable income, up to sort of 18%. And then we've spiked up to 22%, and then now it's falling back. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, slightly. It's just fallen, it's just retraced a little bit in the December quarter. So, anyway, but CBA did some analysis, and they said that basically in a year's time, a year after the stage three tax cuts come in, we're still going to be paying a higher share of our disposable income in taxes than we did before the stage three tax cuts. So basically we're going to give back some bracket creep, but then they're going to take back the bracket creep through further bracket creep.
Yeah.
And we're going to basically be spending a record share of our disposable income on taxes a year after the stage three tax cuts come in. So, yeah, look, it's a temporary reprieve. It's pretty small beer, I think, in the overall size of the economy. And then the government will get some of it back anyway when we get higher bracket creep. It's certainly not a policy whereby they're going to index the tax scales to inflation or something. It's just a one-off.
Yeah.
Give a little bit of it back after it's gone up heaps.
Yeah.
But then we'll take it back through more bracket
creep. And, as an armchair economist as well, that doesn't really bother me as much as saying you've actually got you've set the system to negative drift in terms of saying, yeah, okay, we're going to take more tax over time. And then if things are going well, we can tax cuts. But if things are going badly, then we've actually got the more money without having to raise taxes.
Certainly in the short term, I agree with you. But I think we've got a longer term issue in that the tax system is way too heavily reliant on personal income tax. But that's another topic for another day. And we need, wide, broad-based tax reform. But yeah, certainly get your point. But I think if you take, say, 10-year horizon, it's a recipe for problems.
Yeah, but I guess, that does come back to these points we're talking about, though, we think the competition setting isn't particularly good for Australia. We think the productivity is not set up well Jared Middack described it well. I was trying to remember what it was. You could either add more capital, make your economy more productive, or you can throw more people at the problem and make everyone less productive, every individual less productive, which is exactly...
Which, to be quite frank, that's been Australia's policy the last 20 years. So basically we've... What Jared Minnick was saying, and Dave and I have been saying it for ages as well.
Reason for the start of Macro Business website, just about.
Yeah, pretty much. Basically, we've been growing the economy through people a lot faster than we've grown business investment, infrastructure, and also housing. And what that basically does is it means you got less capital. So not in the accounting sense with money. We're talking about capital stock, so machinery, equipment, etc. Per worker. And then that's basically led to lower productivity growth. And that's, Australia's basically caught in, a bit of a population trap. And so is Canada. So Canada and Australia are running the same sort of system, and we've got exactly the same problems. We're basically growing the population far quicker than we're growing, business investment.
Well, I'd argue as well that at least Canada has a bit of a history of manufacturing
and it's close to the US.
City right next to the US, exactly. That they can, the car companies can easily, manufacture parts in Canada and not really care that, yeah, okay, it's international, but actually it's probably closer to, for a lot of the car companies to in Detroit to manufacture stuff in Canada than it is to manufacture in California. So
yeah, it is. And in fact, you know, there are car companies in Windsor, Ontario, which is just across the lake from Michigan. So
yeah,
you know, whereas we obviously don't have that that luxury being an island nation miles from anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. So sorry, where I was going with this though was, so we're saying we've got so we've set ourselves a competition policy that doesn't seem to be, well, it seems to be suboptimal. We've set ourselves a people problem that seems to be suboptimal. You've just spoken about we've got problems in terms of the tax system is becoming more and more problematic in terms of, and needs restructuring. And there's no political will to fix any of these issues, it looks like. And so I guess that sort of leads me back to this thought that, well, if I'm investing in Australia, what I really need to do is make sure that I'm investing in companies that benefit from the population Ponzi and the squeeze. And so the Transurban, for example, is that type of thing where you're like, yep, yeah, they've already got the toll roads. There's going to be more people jam-packed in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, wherever. And so therefore, and they've got, as you said, you know, most utilities have inflation minus. Like, it's like, yeah, okay, you can have the inflation rate minus 2% or inflation rate minus 1.5%. That's what you're allowed to raise your prices at. Whereas Transurban's managed to get inflation plus. So yeah,
inflation or inflation plus, depending on the contract. There's about 20 of them.
Yeah, but so and it doesn't look like that's changing anytime soon. You could make an argument that say that's a reason to invest in the banks a bit more.
Yeah.
That one always hurts me because I think Australian banks from an investment point of view, they are some of the most profitable banks in the world. And they're also the most expensive banks in the world, particularly CBA. And the question comes back to saying, well, is that just because they've got the closest relationship with the regulators, closer than anywhere else? And that's highly potential. So, you know, I guess the question, it seems to me that the answer from what you're saying still seems to be keep investing in people who are tied to the old economy, as inefficient as it might be.
Oligopoly economy.
The oligopoly.
And you know, so you know, we keep saying Transurban, not just them being able to increase their toll prices, but also the number of people who drive on their roads just gets increased by basically population growth every year. So it's, you know, it's the same with, you know, any of the big retailers, the banks, etc. The customer base is forever expanding through the power of people.
Yeah.
And so it just basically creates a tailwind.
Yeah. And then the flip, so the other side of your portfolio though is saying there's probably a structural reason to be overweight international as well, with that same argument of saying, you know, low productivity and all that type of stuff. Sure, you can have some companies that benefit at the margin, but if you're set up as a low productivity economy and no imminent signs of any change there, then international is sort of makes a lot more sense. That sort of brings us to the question of the week, and then I'll come back to you, Leith, for some thoughts. But you know, the question I really wanted to pose, because this has happened on numerous occasions. We've had bad policy settings, but you know, they call Australia the lucky country because run by second rate politicians, who share in its luck, and Australia does have a penchant for, you know, things happening that are very beneficial to it. So, for example, the rise of China was extremely beneficial for Australia, you know, avoiding recession during the financial crisis. You know, we had the good sense to have lots of iron ore and to be closer to China than Brazil, I think it's been described. And, you know, then again, you know, as iron ore prices were crashing sort of in 2015-16, some huge mining disasters in Brazil, which then pushed the price back up again and sort of gave Australia another push there. I guess your thoughts, Leith, on what's the you gotta bet against Australia becoming lucky one more time?
Well, look, mate, it's probably the widowmaker trade, to be honest with you. Something always seems to come back and, you know, strike us with a bit of lightning.
Yeah.
It's
a rainbow.
That's it. I didn't want to, you know, drop a bad word, but basically, look, you know, who knows? Like, structurally, I think we do a lot of things wrong. So We've basically, you know, somehow engineered us to have one of the most expensive energy markets, at least on the East Coast, in the world, which then makes our manufacturing uncompetitive and then embeds inflation, et cetera, which is just silly.
Yeah.
We do that. Okay. We then
with the added point there that we are the largest, well, one of the top three producers of gas in the world.
We've we are an energy superpower.
Yes.
So we could easily have, you know, that as a competitive advantage in this country. Instead, we make it a disadvantage, which is just bonkers. And I'd also argue that we dilute our, you know, natural wealth.
It's a disadvantage to Australian manufacturers and Australian consumers and all that. It's an advantage to the foreign companies that own all the
cartel.
Yeah. Anyone in the cartel, it's an advantage, yes.
Yeah. So look, we do try and shoot ourselves in the foot, but at the same time, we obviously have enormous, you know, mineral wealth, et cetera, and natural wealth spread amongst still, you know, fairly small share of people. What I do wonder though is in the longer run, if exporting fossil fuels, et cetera, does become, a thing of the past, well then what does Australia do? But that's more a very longer term perspective.
Yeah.
I think we'll probably just muddle through like we always do. We'll get a bit of luck. But the thing that I care about more is, you know, is the everyday Australians' living standards going up? And I don't think they really have improved much in the last 20 years. And I think in a lot of ways, things have gotten worse. I can sort of see that, you know, gradual degradation of living standards continuing under the sort of policy settings that we have.
Yeah. Well, and that would say to me, though, that's a recipe for more political
discontent.
And you know, I've said on here many times before, but, you know, I do think the rise of Trump is a large way part from people who are doing really poorly and getting, you know, median wages going backwards for decades, being told that, hey, you've never had it so good. And they're feeling like maybe that doesn't feel that way. And I think there's, you know, it leaves you open to demagogues, because if we've got politicians standing up talking about how great our economy is while we've got, you know, mired in a per capita recession, then if somebody who actually turns around and tells people, well, no, you don't have it very good, can then, you know, end up as Trumpian type bigots.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one area where things are gonna come, yeah, it could potentially come a cropper is, you know, obviously the housing market. So we've got obscenely expensive house prices, we've got a rental crisis, and I think we now are getting to a stage where we have enough people in the rental market to actually cause headaches for the politicians. And we're seeing the Greens trying to sort of take advantage of that. Unfortunately, they're also arguing for more immigration as well, which undermines their whole argument. But, you know, I think renters have been ignored probably for too long, and that's going to start becoming a pinch point as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's my policy suggestion for you, Leith. And I'd like to see you pick a hole. It'd be interesting to see what you think where the holes are. I've kicked around with Dave a few times, but the idea is basically saying, look, do we just need a housing authority whose mission it is to get rents, whatever it is, you know, rent on a two-bedroom, the median two-bedroom house below X percent of whatever the minimum wage is, and their job's just to go out and build shit until... And to build stuff and rent it hire other people to build it and rent it until we get there.
Yeah.
It seems obvious that we're not going to be able to get actual house prices down, but maybe targeting rents is a better solution.
Yeah. Look, to be honest with you, I actually don't have a problem with that. The only thing is, like, so for example, I actually don't mind the Greens policy that much. There's a lot of good points. The problem is they then want to increase the immigration intake even more, which is just sort of makes the whole thing, you know, self-defeating. Mm. But, you know, you can do both. You can slow the migration intake down to historical levels, about 100 a year, round about that, which served us fine until 2005, and then suddenly it was no longer enough. And then do all those sorts of things as well, and you'd solve the problem. So,
yeah,
you know.
And if you're building 300,000, 400,000 houses a year and new cities and all that type of stuff, then we could handle 700,000 people coming in, couldn't we? I guess I'm saying, is that the economy you want, where you just, we're going to have an economy that builds stuff so that more people can come here, so that we build stuff so that more people can come here. It sounds the Chinese economy, you know, designed around building all this stuff for people to live in cities, and then one day it finishes and you're stuck.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like, yeah, mate, to be honest with you, I think that's actually got a bit of merit, your proposal. And it's kind of, you know, Singapore does that sort of thing. So, yeah, well, I mean, not exactly the same, but they obviously have, you know, huge public housing stock where, you know, most Singaporeans rent, and it seems to work quite well. So, yeah, we could certainly improve in a lot of areas. But I think the first best thing to do is to stop juicing demand so much through extra warm bodies. And then take all these other measures first, because that can be done very quickly.
Build it first and then let them come, rather than
let them come and then worry about the consequences later.
Yeah, that's right. Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Leith. Appreciate you having you on once again. We'll try and make sure it's not as long as before we do the next one. Before I go, I just want to highlight to people. So we've spoken a bit about direct indexing, and we've discussed it several times on the show. So that's something Nucleus is, and the MB Fund is a pioneer of. And so direct indexing is very much about taking portfolios. It's basically like taking an ETF, splitting it out, and adding more of what you want and taking out what you don't want. There is a conference coming up in the next couple of weeks. So we're in Melbourne on the, and so this is, sorry, this is IMAP. We'll be a presenter there. So it's an Institute of Managed Account Professionals running this. And so in Melbourne on the 18th and Sydney on the 21st, there's a blog post up on our website where you can register for that. We'll send out some emails if you're on our email list as well. But yeah, certainly all welcome to join that and discuss about the next generation of investing through there. With that said, thanks everyone. We have, we just want to highlight, you know, you can grab our, if you're looking for more Nucleus research or comments, you can get us on most social media platforms. You get this podcast, which is live every Thursday at 12:30. You can get it on YouTube, Spotify, Google Podcasts, all sort of major and minor platforms. And if you've got any thoughts or comments for guests, feel free to pop us an email or drop it in the comments section. Thanks everyone for coming, and we'll see you all next week.